Welcome to Wyoming Stories. I'm Micah Schweitzer. On this podcast, we bring you stories about Wyomingites in their own words. This month, mischief in Wyoming. For better or for worse, getting into trouble usually makes for a good story. We'll start with Harold Turner. Harold grew up on the Triangle X Ranch in Jackson Hole. In this story, he tells his son, Robert Turner, how some childhood mischief taught him a valuable lesson.
In my day and age, our parents were what I consider had to be the greatest generation this country has ever seen. They had been through the Depression. They had been through the war. They still had family values, where things that we don't have that were honored, such as friendships and reliability and respect and loyalty. This is something that they had because of the hardships that they had been through, and that people were all they could rely upon, friends, relatives, so forth. And I think that we have lost a great deal of that. But, of course, that was the norm for families. I mean, you could get in trouble, but you had a person had these characteristics that would, I think, take hold when we got in trouble. And I remember one time when Pete Hansen and I were very good friends, and he and I took our .22s and shot off every insulator on the telephone lines going all the way up through Spring Gulch, all the way up through their property, into the Lucas's property. 100 and some odd insulators we shot off. And we put 3 telephone lines out of commission. And some of the telephone lines that we put out of commission, at the other end, there was ranches that had 3 very pregnant women. And in those days, the telephone was essential because the men were always out in the field. And if they went into labor, they had to have somebody come and help them. And if you did that now, you'd end up in juvenile court and in Worland, in the detention center. But the police and the Bell Telephone Company got Pete and I and Cliff and Martha and Mother and Dad in the old telephone office. And they literally read us the riot act. And our punishment was not going to Worland or Rollins or wherever they incarcerate people. Our punishment was that for 1 month we had to mop and clean the telephone office. Well, it lasted 3 days. I think the telephone people decided they would rather do it themselves, and they let us loose. But that probably taught us more, not because of what we had already been taught of respecting people, respecting other people's property. And we were old enough to realize what could have happened if one of those ladies had, and that, you know, your actions, you have to kind of look and see and figure out what's going to happen down the road.
That's Harold Turner from Jackson Hole talking with his son Robert. The piece was produced by Crystal Brown. Next, we'll hear from Rollins resident Dwayne Schillinger. In 1967, Dwayne was hired by the Wyoming State Penitentiary as a counselor, and later he ended up serving as warden for 17 years. In this story, he remembers the transition from the 19th century facility to the current modern one and the relationships he formed with inmates.
I spent about 16 years over here in this old prison, what's now called the Wyoming Frontier Prison. I was actually the last warden at that prison, and then I was the first warden at the new prison. And I also hold the dubious distinction of being the longest-serving warden in Wyoming prison history. It's often been said that those early prisons were built that when a prisoner saw them, you know, they would immediately be in fear, you know, that the state was in charge, the state was, you know, this kind of a monster that was going to control their life. And that's kind of what the old prison looked like, you know, cold walls and bars. And so then the new prison was designed, and the inmates at first resisted. They did not want to leave over here. You know, they had their life situation pretty well established. They knew their routine. They had their cell fixed the way they wanted it. They had the hobby work and so forth. And this over here was, you know, totally unknown. They had no idea what they were going to be moved into. One old inmate told us, he says, "I'm not going to go over there. You're going to have to drag me over. I'm not going to go." So my deputy warden, his name was Jim Ferguson, and I, we talked a little bit about it, how what we were going to do with him. And I said, "Let's just leave him here until we get everybody moved, and then we'll come back and sit down with him, and he'll be the last one to go." So we've got everybody moved, and on the first day and the second day, and he was still down there waiting for us. "I'm not going to go. You're not going to make me go." And then when we got him all over there, we went and found him. He was living in there all by himself. And, of course, we had some guards. But he had taken all of the mattresses out of the cells, neatly stacked them. He had swept the floor and mopped the floor. It was immaculate. And he just said, "Okay, I'm ready to go." And so he was the last one that we took over there. But when I was being prepped to be the warden, you know, they told me to keep an eye on what type of a community you want out there. What are you going to do? Well, I had some ideas. As I look back on it now in my older age, I think, oh, that was foolish. That was youthful excitement, you know, that kind of propelled me in. But anyhow, I wanted to develop a community where they had a responsibility within that community. They had a role to play, and that role was being a good citizen, you know, treating other people decently, courteously, backing away from the violence, trying to do what they could to, you know, foster their own well-being, better their education. Let me tell you a little story here about one inmate. It was a young kid. In fact, he still writes letters to me, and I answer him. He came in. He was a life sentence, and he was just a little pain in the rear end. I mean, he was hard to manage, and we did everything we could with him to try to get him on the straight and narrow, get him involved and so forth, and he just would not accept guidance. He didn't want to be involved. He wanted to be a little hoodlum. I got to the point where there wasn't anything else I could do with him. I had him locked up in the last place I could lock him up, all by himself. And at that particular time, we had a semi-religious program come in, and they had done a lot of work in prisons. And one of the interesting people in that program was a car driver for Al Capone. I still remember this. I got with this fellow and told him about this kid, and I told him, I said, "You know, we don't know what else to do with him." I said, "You know, I just hate, he's young, I hate to just lock him up." And I said, "Would you talk to him?" And he said, "Yeah, I'll talk to him." So I went back, and this kid's name was Scott. I sat down with him, and so I told him, I said, "Scott, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. You know, I've come to the end of my rope, and I hate to just write you off." I said, here's the deal. And I told him about this program. I told him about this old convict. This old guy had white hair, and you could see, you know, just looking at his face, the experiences he had been through. And told him that he was Al Capone's car driver. And I said, "Will you talk to him?" Yeah, I'll talk to him. So that night we had the program. And, of course, there was, you know, a lot of religion mixed into it. And the leader, you know, toward the end of the program asked, "Now, would anybody like to come up and give themselves to Christ? And lo and behold, this kid popped out of his chair and walked up there. And that was the change in his life. And, he's still connected with me. I tried to make it a decent place for them to live. Every one of them that came in, I met every inmate when they first came into the prison, sat down and had a chat with them, and I told them, now, these are your options. I said, you can come in here and be a jerk, be a criminal if you want to, be a hood, or, you can try to start getting your life squared away. And I'd point them out some of the programs we had, and that was the beginning of it. Then I would meet all of the inmates. I'd walk through the yard. I would spend time in their cell with them, and they called me Dad. The prison was the big part of my life. I've spent almost 29 years in that prison, and it's hard to separate thoughts now from the prison, and get a little bit emotional when I think about it.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark.
That was former Wyoming State Penitentiary Warden Dwayne Schillinger from Rawlins. The piece was produced by Adrian Shirk. Okay, now for some Old West outlaws. Buster and Sherry Johnson, they're not the outlaws, they recount the stories of Dutch Charlie and Big Nose George. They were a couple of infamous Wyoming criminals. This is a cautionary tale. If you're thinking of robbing a train in Wyoming like Charlie or George, think again. You might end up in a pickle jar.
There's stories about old outlaws and stuff around here, too.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked on the home ranch there, up on the head of Rattlesnake, there's a monument that said, murdered here August 19th, 1876. Tip Vincent of Rawlins and Robert Whittefield of Carbon. They were chasing Dutch Charlie and Big Nose George, who had robbed a train and making a getaway. And another cowboy and I were riding through there, and I showed it to him, and I was telling the story. When they rode up there, they checked and said the BASTARDS can't be too far away because the fire's still warm. And about that time, they were shot, and the outlaws got away. But they caught Big Nose George later. Well, they caught Dutch Charlie and had to take him through Carbon on the way to Rawlins, where the county seat is. And the vigilantes jerked him off the train and made him confess to everything and then hung him there on a telegraph pole. And Big Nose George, they caught him later. They were up in Montana bragging about what they'd done down here. And word got out, and they brought Big Nose George back through Carbon, and they didn't get him off the train, but he said that he'd confess everything in Rawlins. And there's quite a bit story about Big Nose George. And he was hung there in Rawlins, and they cut the top of his skull off to see what made him so mean, and it was used as an ashtray. And
didn't they pickle some of his?
Well, yeah, they took his hide and made shoes, and one of the governors wore his shoes, I think. And then in early 50s, they found a pickle barrel when they were remodeling a building in the basement, and it was Big Nose George remains in it. Brought history back to life again.
That was Buster and Sherry Johnson from Elk Mountain. The piece was produced by Cordelia Zars. We'll finish off with a story from Frank, Bert, and Bob Johnson. The three brothers grew up on the A1 ranch outside of Elk Mountain, and they made it their job to wreak as much havoc as they could on the ranch and in the schoolhouse.
We all three went to school at the ranch, didn't have any school. Too far to go to school, so we had the school teacher stay with us.
Yeah. And that four ranch kids out there that really had a lot of fun with some of these school teachers, because one of them was just a young lady, and she got scared walking over to the schoolhouse one day because she saw something move under the sidewalk, and the wind was blowing a feather. we thought, well, gee, if she's that afraid, well, maybe we ought to arrange so she can see a mouse every now and then, you know, or something, because we had a real easy afternoon. So she saw quite a few mice then, and I think she lasted 6 months. One of our aunts, my dad's sister, Dorothy, was teaching school there, and so we decided to be a good idea. Back in those days, we could get these firecrackers about 2.5 inches long, and they loaded into a big can of sulfur, and they used it to scare the coyotes away. They'd go off about every 10, 15 minutes. So we had an ample supply of 2.5-inch firecrackers, so we got some dynamite fuse, and we fixed our own little blow-up thing, and we put it under the schoolhouse and ran the fuse out through the crack in the rocks, you know. And Aunt Dorothy rang the bell, and by gollies, we all ran in, and about 5 minutes, she always read a story right after the noon lunch hour. She always read a story, so we was sitting there reading a story, and all of a sudden, just happened to be under her desk, firecracker went off, and she jumped. We started laughing, and then another one went off, and she jumped, and that was the end of the story. She never read any more that day. We had a test that afternoon for some reason. I can't remember why. Well, I remember one time when we was kids, you know, we had a lot of fun, and Bert, he was kind of a little bit younger than Bob and I, and not quite as agile back then, and we climbed up on top of the barn. Me and Bob climbed up the gate and up on top of the barn, and Bert couldn't climb up there, and it had rained the night before, and Mom heard this god-awful caterwauling going out there, and Bert was so mad that he stuck his head down the mud puddle and screamed and hollered and just raised havoc because we wouldn't. We was up on the barn laughing at him, and that really helped.
Well, what about the time you drove me off the hill in his tire?
Oh, that was another. Yeah, had a great big old truck tire, and we worked half a day to get it pushed away up the big hill there. And said, okay, who's going to get in and ride it? Oh, yeah. I was too big. I was a little heavy at the time. So we talked Bert into getting inside that. And we'll turn the tire loose, and here's Bertie going down the hill inside this big truck tire. It would have been all right, except the truck tire hit the side of the barn and bounced back about 20 feet. It was going pretty good. Fell over on the side, and we come running down the hill, and Bert was still inside the tire. It took him probably 5 minutes or more to get out of that tire. It knocked him silly. That's probably what's wrong with him now. And the time we was out counting bucks now. We had buck sheep, and all three of us boys went with Dad. Bob went with Dad to help him count the bucks, and Bert and I are staying at the pickup.
No,
you didn't go
there.
You didn't go count the bucks?
Okay. He got whipped.
Anyway, Dad come back. I had a hole in the back of my head, and blood in his T-shirt was soaked with blood. He shot me with a sling shot with a little piece of corn. And the point of that corn went right in there. Instead of whipping whoever, well, Dad grabbed Bob and whapped his butt.
I threw my slingshot away.
Yeah.
And
Dad wailed the heck out of Bob, and Bob had his pockets full of rocks.
I knew what was coming.
And he picked him up and shook the rocks out of his pocket. And then he got a whipping.
Well, we used to always get whippings. Something went wrong, well, Mom would line us all up and just whip us all. Just so she made sure you get the right one. We survived.
And, you know, we probably deserved 9/10 of them.
Yeah.
Or 10
or 110% of them.
Yeah. But, you know, you have to have a little authority in life.
At the Trumbull School, there'll be a dance. Go there if I get the chance.
That was the Johnson brothers, Frank, Bert, and Bob from Elk Mountain. The piece was produced by Cordelia Zars. That's it for this edition of Wyoming Stories. We'll have a new podcast on the first Monday of each month. You can find more Wyoming stories online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The music you're hearing was written by Jeff Troxell. Cordelia Czars produced the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. Wyoming Stories is a production of Wyoming Public Media.